Officer of Committee on Transportation. And the next item on the agenda is the Manufactured Structure Titling Work Group Report and Discussion. Now, that's a long title. But let's bring up John Miner and Diane Belt and Kelly Taylor. And Janet, if you want to provide kind of a quick overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I was staff to the work group, and I'm going to open with just a submission. I'll go later. I put at your places during the break the work group report. The first page of the report just explains the current roles for the different agencies, the VMB and DCBS, and how we got to the point of forming the work group. You'll remember that nobody really thought that people's homes needed to be titled and registered as vehicles with DMV any longer just because they were manufactured structures. But everybody, from homeowners to lenders to tax collectors, wanted their interest in the homes to be protected with an efficient and simple tracking and notification system. You may recall a degree of skepticism in at your January meeting that a better system could be developed. So Representative Starr, as the chair, didn't ask the work group members to necessarily support a change, but he asked them to come up with the best alternative system that they could. The second page of the report just lists the work group members. I think you've seen some of this before. It also lists some of the meetings and outside groups that these work group members have presented a proposal to, because they've been busy not just developing a proposal but talking about it with their counterparts and associations that they're involved with statewide. Page 3 and 4 of the report lists the major changes that will come under the proposal. And then the attachments that were developed by Diane Belt all show kind of an outline of the process from different points of view. Under the proposal, dealers are going to initiate the ownership and tracking paperwork for new homes. And for secondary homes, homeowners and escrow agents will begin the transfer and relocation paperwork directly with the county. There's no additional trip and paperwork shuttle to and from DMV. DMV's out of the picture for the paperwork transfer about home ownership. Most of the paperwork will be able to be filed electronically if counties and dealers are test electronic capability with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and that's where the program would go, DMV's portion of the program would go under a streamlined system with CCBS. So DCBS will keep a central database and issue ownership documents and all the required notices. As noted in the report, DCBS already has a manufactured housing program, and they deal with the building code side of manufactured structure programs in Oregon, and so they already have a database, and this would be a transfer of DMV's information and their ownership documentation into that database. I just wanted you to know that the statutory changes that are required to forward the work group's proposal are being drafted by legislative council. It's going to be a lengthy bill because of the number of related statutes that need to be changed. The work group first saw the draft for last week, and it's already 226 pages. Legislative council really did a remarkable job with it. Some reworking is needed, so it's back at Legislative Council, and we won't be considering introduction today. It will need to be introduced probably after the session starts. So it won't be ready for, will not be ready for pre-session filing. The workers today, Don Miner, can give some dealer perspective on the proposed changes. Diane Belt, Washington County, tax collector, the county's role, and how they see that this benefiting them and the homeowners. Kelly Taylor from ODOT, if you have any questions, especially about the transfer of data and responsibility. Our DCBS representatives could not come today, but they've been very active, and they're ready for the program to come to them. It's not going to have an immediate effective date, a delayed effective date, but they're ready for the program to be transferred to them if the bill passes. And Pat Schwab is in the audience from the manufactured homeowners, if you have any questions about their relationship, the work group. And John Brenneman from the Manufactured Housing Association is also in the housing community, excuse me, is also in the audience. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'd Don, do you want to start?
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. Our association represents generally manufacturers, retailers, lenders, transporters, installers, etc., but not landlords. I want to begin by thanking you for taking this task on, and particularly your committee administrator. She's done a lot of hard work. She said that it's a 226-page bill. We were told initially it would be 255 pages, so she's brought some improvements there, nowhere else. Many of you may remember that when this idea was first discussed, we didn't embrace it very warmly. But as the industry has had an opportunity to look at the proposal and to think through where it might take us, the industry has now turned a corner on that, and there's broad support for this idea. I've given you a little handout. I won't spend much time on it, but it's sort of a snapshot of where the industry is economically. The first page is a survey we do of reported repossessions of manufactured homes. Almost all of those repossessions are located within mobile home parks. This report is a survey of the 7th largest lenders in the Northwest. As of today, there are about 2 lenders willing to finance homes in parks. And so that's creating a great deal of difficulty for families as they attempt to sell their homes and reap some economic benefit from that sale. In many cases, consumers find that they can't sell them except for cash. In many cases, they're been forced to abandon the homes to the lenders. And oftentimes, the lenders are abandoning them to the park owners. So there's an economic crisis going on. I've given you a chart here. It basically shows single-family home permits as the number of those in relationship to the number of manufactured homes shipped to Oregon. You can see the site-built permits are going up. Ours are going down. The last page is a comparison of it shows the percentage of manufactured homes as a percentage of single-family homes. That's the top line. And then of all housing, which would include single-family, multifamily, and manufactured. You can see we're reaching all-time lows. One of the things we see this proposal doing is bringing some credibility to the industry by making it look more house-like and less car-like. And so going over to the Building Codes Division, we think will bring that benefit to us. The Building Codes Division currently regulates manufacturers of manufactured homes. They're in the plants, they inspect the homes as they're being produced. They also regulate the installation of manufactured homes into the site. They have regulatory authority over some aspects of what transporters do, and they have some regulatory authority over what dealers do under federal law. By putting this piece in building codes, we think that it will benefit the industry by generating an economy of scale, so that our regulatory costs may be reduced. We think it'll make government more efficient, and I'm not sure that people always like to see efficient government, but in this case, we think that those efficiencies will benefit both ourselves and consumers. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Diane Belt. I represent the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors, and I'm also the personal property tax collector for Washington County. What Don said about the industry is very true. In 1995, just so you can kind of understand what's happened with this industry, and then I'll talk about why the county's interested in this process. I think I am the queen of abandoned homes. Washington County has had 383 abandoned homes, manufactured homes, since 1995, and that equates to a value of over $11 million. So yes, the industry is in trouble. The counties are also, with Measure 50, we are short-staffed. We're trying to streamline things, make things work more efficient for us as well as the customer. in getting together and talking about this, I was like, Don, you know, Jesus has been doing this forever. Why do we need to change it? It's not broken. Let's not fix it. But I think the more we talked about it and the more we looked at how the industry has grown in a short period of time, and when I started in 1978, they were mobile homes. Now they are manufactured structures, and they are more sided to a regular stick-built home. If you've ever gone through some of the homes that they manufacture, they're absolutely beautiful. So I started thinking about it and thought there does have to be a better way to do this, and it seemed like the logical place for people to come to do their business was at the county, because they have to come see us first anyway. So that's kind of how this developed. The new homes, Don's dealers deal with those, so it seemed like it was natural for a dealer to take care of the new homes coming onto the system. And when Dana from DCBS said they were interested in the whole process, I thought, whew, I think we better get hold of this guy and not let go of him. So the process developed from there. In a nutshell, what's going to happen is that the consumer on secondary housing or homes that are already in the system will come to the county. The county at that time will process the title transfer, the movement, or whatever's happening with that home. The upside for us is the fact that once that person walks out the door, that transaction is done. We're able to update our records. We're able to gather data and information that we've never been able to collect, such as sales price. We don't have a database for sales, so it's really hard to do an appraisal on a manufactured home, unlike real property where you track all of those sales histories. So that's a real plus for the county, plus the fact that too many times when somebody comes in now, they get their paperwork, they put it in their folder, they think they're done. On personal property, when the taxes aren't paid, we record a judgment, which becomes a blip on your credit rating, and if you're the person that sold that home and the buyer didn't transfer the title, it becomes an issue. This opens up the door for us to try to deal with those problems and try to help the consumer. I think it's a protection for the consumer, because they're going to have one person to deal with, and that's going to be the county. We will be an agent of DCBS. We want this to be an online system so that when somebody walks out the door, it's a done deal. And that's where the county, and talking with all the different counties, everybody's ready for this move, and I think everybody's excited about it. As a matter of fact, we will be meeting tomorrow to kind of go over some of the data elements that we'll be looking for and the process in general, and we've had real good response. And with that, I would answer any questions.
Kelly, why don't you go ahead and testify, and then we'll open up for questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Cater with the Department of Transportation, and I don't have any prepared remarks. I want to tell you that we've been involved with the meetings throughout, and our role has been as a resource of information of helping bounce ideas off of, you know, us. What do you think? Will this work? How does it work today? What do your forms collect today? What does it look like today? And can you help us tomorrow as we build the new system? And our answer has been yes all along. We'll continue to be a resource to help DCBS as they build the system. And one of the big questions has been the database that we've maintained, because that's really a big source of information that people have relied upon. One of the main reasons we've been involved in the process. And DCBS has a database where they have been tracking homes from the builder's standpoint as they've been built. And one of the meetings that the county's hosted, they've hosted several of them, our data processing folks came to that specific meeting, and DCBS's data processing folks came to that specific meeting and did their little techie talk and said, you know, this is really doable. And it's really a matter of us helping them build the fields of information that we already have that they don't have, and us spinning off the data into whatever form they'd like, and then loading their files. So it's very, very possible to transfer the data. And that was a big question, and I just want you to know that we've looked at it, and they've looked at it, and you can do that. And I know Rep. Sonner will appreciate that, because he likes to tease about the computer system, but the computer system is a necessary component of this particular program. So anyway, we'll be there to help with the forms, the data transfer, and we think that the counties and the manufactured folks have come up with a good idea. It's certainly better than what we've got going right now.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you very much for your testimony. Quick question, as far as the task force is concerned regarding flow of funds. Currently, DMV collects fees for the processes that you do. Is there a problem transferring those fees collection from DMV to DCBS? Is there going to be an additional dollar amount that's going to be needed for, in the DCBS budget item to facilitate the transfer over and above what DMV already collects? Is this going to cost us any more money?
Mr. Chair, I don't know what costing out DCBS has done. They don't believe so. We've looked at, actually, there'll be a little less work done because we won't be registering the vehicles. There'll be an ownership document, which there is today. There won't be a registration process going on. There won't be a plate process going on. So it's actually a little less work in that regard. And I don't know if the counties have looked at it, but, you know, these folks are in the county's offices today getting the paperwork, having them check records about taxes paid in order to take that paperwork to DMV and then come back to the county. So the counties are seeing this workload today, and these people are in their offices today. So what it, I think the answer is no, it should not cost more. If anything, it will probably cost a little less.
Good answer.
If I may speak to that also, Mr. Chair, there's my understanding there's also likely to be a companion piece of legislation that amends the Oregon Constitution to make sure that all funds that currently collected by DMV flow over to BCD so that they should in fact have sufficient funds to administer this program.
Very good. Other questions? Comments?
Mr. Chair, thank you. It looks to me, based on what you've said, is that whatever the paperwork flow is internally, the owner and the person who's doing a transaction will see that there's a single transaction taking place at the county. And I'm getting nods, and that's obviously a vast improvement over the system that we have now, and would be an example of at least the public perception of decreasing regulation and decreasing government red tape. And in that sense, I think it's a great idea.
If there's nothing else from the committee, I'd just like to say thanks to the for the work that everybody's put into this. You know, as I wandered the halls with a glazed look in my eyes last session, not the special sessions, but the regular session, and, you know, bumped into Kelly, and I was saying, this doesn't make sense that DMV got its hands in these manufactured homes more than that. There's got to be a better way, and I'm glad that that you put your collective minds together and found a way to make this thing work better, and I think that Oregonians ultimately will be more well-served, better served because of that. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's move on down our agenda. We've got the bridge rehabilitation status options, a report from ODOT regarding the bridge situation.
Chair Starr, Chair Brown, members of the committee. I'm John Rosenberger. I'm the Executive Deputy of the Highway Division for ODOT. With me today is Paul Mather, who is the Region 3 Manager for ODOT. We're here today to give you an update on bridges in Oregon. Almost a year ago, Mark Kuroda, the State Bridge Engineer, made a presentation to this committee on the status of bridges in Oregon, and in particular highlighted the cracked bridge problem. At the same time, Director Warner established a bridge strategy task force to look at the cracked bridge problem and to make recommendations to the department on how we address the problem. In June of this year, The task force confirmed that the cracked bridge problem is real. They also recommended that the department move from a worst first repair and replacement of bridges to a corridor approach, focusing on I-5 and I-84. The corridor approach was recommended to allow freight and the economy of Oregon to continue rather than to spread bridge repair and replacement across the state in a non-systematic way. What we'd like to do today is to give you an update on the progress that we have made to date, additional information that has been collected over the last year, to preview a bridge options report, and to lay out some options that the department has considered, both current actions underway as well as future actions. In June of this year, as I mentioned, the Bridge Task Force concluded their recommendations. Director Warner established the Bridge Options Team, headed by Paul Mather, within the department to lay out what the options and the impact on the economy cracked bridges have. That report will include specific recommendations on the most effective and efficient way to use existing resources and new investment to address I-5 and I-84. At this point, I would like to turn it over to Paul to go through his report, and then I will conclude with some of the current actions and some of the future actions that the department is undertaking.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Region 3 manager and project manager for the Bridge Options Report. I just want to go over with you today, as John was outlining, the progress that we're making on the report and what our plans are, and preview some of the information that you have. I'm going to be referring to a PowerPoint presentation I've passed out to you and kind of walk you through where we're at, to show you some things that we're coming up with the report, and just to help keep me on track as we go through the presentation. First slide there is just, again, purpose of today is the timeline for the report, some background and some preview for the report. The overall timeline is on the next page. As you heard in previous reports from our bridge engineer, Mark Hirota, we have some bridge problems in the state, and they've been compounded by some recent cracks that we found in certain designs of bridges. And that, as John just talked about, prompted the director to put together the bridge task force that had several different recommendations. The report that I'm working on is the bridge options report, is really in preparation for our commission, in preparation for the legislative session starting in January, to lay out some options that we have to solve the problem in front of us. Just some background, moving through the document, remembering back to 97, we did some analysis at that point for our highway plan, and really saw that in the state we had a bridge problem in front of us. Most of our bridges in the state were built 40 plus years ago, and since bridges last somewhere between 50, 75 to 100 years, we have a curve of bridges in front of us that we need to replace. As we move through the next several years, we noticed this crack phenomenon in a certain type of design that was pretty prevalent in the late 50s when we were doing the majority of our bridge construction for the interstate and other key routes in the state. As a result of that, you see in that chart the emergency repairs and postings have steadily gone up and have been increasing over the last several years. And currently we're at about 2.5% of our bridges in the state system have some kind of restrictions on them today. And I'll get more into where those numbers are going as I go through this. Just some examples on the next page from around the state of some of the bridge crises that we've had in different communities. Some of you may be more familiar with some of these than others. Forge Bridge in just north of Canyonville, Riddle area, is one that I'm very familiar with, being from Southwest Oregon, where we had to restrict traffic on the freeway, truck traffic on the freeway, to 64,000 pounds, which means essentially any loaded 18-wheel truck was not allowed on the freeway. And the detour route we had in place wasn't able to accommodate the 105.5-pound annual permitted loads, or the heavier haul loads had to go completely around the area. Tremendous impact on the community, tremendous impact on the trucking industry from a cost standpoint, and lasted for roughly 3 weeks. Several of those things have played out. Poles Bridge in John Day area had huge impacts on a mill as that bridge was restricted. Sauvage Island Bridge in the Portland area is actually a local agency bridge that was restricted. But each one of those on a very local level had huge impacts for a period of time on those communities. And the picture we paint in the report is those type of localized examples are going to be more and more prevalent as we move through the future of our bridges. The Bridge Task Force report that we've talked about a couple times lists the recommendations that were there. The key ones, again, were move from a worst first to a corridor approach in our approach to the problem, fix I-84 and I-5 first. OT is helping us on the next slide. In the last legislative session, as you're all aware, the OTIA funding prescribed money for bridges, and we've selected those bridges on the freeway as outlined there, as well as 36 bridges in the local system, which aren't shown on the map, but have really made started to make a dent in what we've got in front of us. The next two slides represent really the problem in front of us. The first slide is of the state bridges that are out there that are either cracked or restricted in some way today, and the following slide is the same data for the local system of the non-state city and county bridges that are out there. Just pause here for a minute on the on either one of these slides. Our future, or where we want to be, is not to have any restrictions. We recognize that for the economy of the state to work, we don't need to have every bridge to be able to handle any given load. Probably at the farthest end of the spectrum is the covered bridges that we have. Recognize those type of bridges are always going to be posted and need to be posted, and we'll have certain bridges like that will fall in that category. But both these slides depict the scale of the problem, as well as the diversity around the state of the problem that's in front of us. The next slide gets to kind of where we are today and where we see the problem going on the state side. And for the state bridges, we have 2,680 bridges. Of those, about 2.5% of those are posted today. We're going through and doing an element-by-element portion of the bridge, or what we call a load rating of the bridge, of all our bridges. That's required by Federal Highway Administration. Based on what we found today, we're projecting by July that number is going to increase or double to about 5% of our bridges. And you'll see in later slides predict that to actually go 30% of our bridges by 2010. They'll have some restrictions on them. Just to give you some previews on the report and trying to tie those bridge problems into an economic impact for the state that we have in front of us. The purpose of the report is just to lay out different options or array options for our commission, as well as the governor and the legislature in the months to come. The content of the report will outline the problem, establish or build that relationship between bridge, freight, and the economy that we have in the state, and I'll give you a little hint of what we've discovered so far. Three basic options that we're looking at to kind of illustrate the problem. First is to depict what the current level of investment results for us. If we continue down the path we are today, where is that going to lead us? The next one, what if we proactively limit those heavier loads that are out there today and restrict it to 80,000 pound trucks? What does that do to the economy? Pretty devastating to both the industry as well as the economy. And the last is where we're going with our recommendation. The report is the investments and what type of investments need to be made in our system to minimize the impact on the economy and keep our economy flourishing. The appendix of the report will be quite extensive, a lot of detail that we've uncovered as we put this together. Just some background for you, just on freight in general. Trucks represent 70% of the freight in Oregon. You've probably seen this chart before in different presentations, but trucking is predominant in the state. And really, our opportunities for rail and water, as you're probably aware, are limited just to the geography of the state and where a lot of our goods and services need to travel. The very bottom highlighted box on there, I'd point out to you that nearly a third of our goods in the state are shipped in those loads that are between 80,000 pounds and 105.5. Those are the loads that are going down the road that have more than five axles on them. Your typical truck, 80,000 pounds, have five axles under them. Any load that you see, the doubles, the triples are probably the most obvious one, but there's a lot of other loads besides triples out there that are 105.5, but nearly a third of the goods in the state are transferred in those type of loads. to give you, on the next slide, to give you some representation of what type of commodities are shipped in those heavier loads. That next slide outlines that. One of the examples I'd like to use here is gasoline. Most of the gasoline in the state, in fact, virtually all the gasoline in the state, comes from pipelines, Portland or Eugene, and is moved from those into those pipelines to the service stations in those 155-pound loads. And you see those gasoline trucks go down the interstate with the trailer in the back. Those are all annual permitted heavy light loads. If we were to limit just in that commodity, limit those to 80,000 pounds, not only would the industry have to go through a complete retooling, there would be an increased travel cost, increased amount of drivers, increased insurance, increased cost to the consumer. Probably it's hard to actually translate all that out to what would actually be back to the consumer, but roughly in a penny or two increase that you'd see at the pump just from that alone. In general, we're seeing about a 10% increase in transportation costs for a commodity, and that's a very gross number, but in general that's a rule of thumb that we're seeing with these different commodities with making those kind of shifts. The next slide, the map of Oregon slide that shows you the share of state production of heavy goods around the states, really shows you that the prominence of the economy in Oregon is driven by the Portland metro area, with the large amount of production that happens in that area, but it is substantial in other portions of the state as well, as you can see in that chart. The next one with the little pie graphs around the state show you the share of that economy that is dependent on those heavier loads that I was describing, those loads of between 80,000 pounds and 155. As you can see, virtually every portion of the state is highly dependent on those heavier loads from around the state. The next slide gets a little more confusing. I'll just give you a glimpse of it here, and then we'll go through and talk about the meaning of it. And this is that the chart with the different colors on it. As I've been talking about the level restrictions, if you move from left to right on that page, your level restrictions go from 100% or basically posting all bridges to 80,000 pounds, clear to the right where every bridge is fixed. We've divided the highways, and I'll show you a slide here of that in a second, but we've divided the highways up into four different categories, starting with the interstate, freight routes, and local routes, and then try to show an array across that chart of different options that we have. We'll move on to the next slide. Explains what the different colors are. In that chart, the green are the not restricted. When we say not restricted, we're talking about very, very heavy loads. In the industry, weight table 5 is what we talk about. But these are the cranes, these are the logging equipment, these are the power transformers that need to be delivered to the communities, these are the one-time single permit loads that need to go across bridges. The limited category of the yellow is where we're assuming we're doing repairs to the bridge that's going to allow the heavier loads, the 155 loads, to go across, but not those single permit loads to go across. And we can do repairs that may last up to 10 years. The red is what we assume we're going to restrict the route or the bridges to 80,000 pounds as an option. If you look on the next map or the next page, you'll see a map that shows those four different categories of highways that I talked about. The purple is the interstate, kind of moving down the hierarchy of roads there. The next orange color is the freight routes that are out there. The blue color is the key state routes. There's also key bridges that are on here in the local system that aren't depicted on the map. And the brown color is basically all the rest of the routes. It's kind of how we hierarchied out for our analysis. And then back to that chart on the next page, kind of explains how we move again from our post all 100%. The next one is a current investment at 30%, and then clear to the right where we have no restrictions on our system. At the bottom is the cost figures that we have come up with to get to those very broad options that we've presented, the additional dollars on top of what we need currently to our program. As you'll see, as you get down clear to the right for the no restrictions, we approach $5 billion that we would need to get all our bridges to having no restrictions on them. Where we are currently with the report is taking this specific information and moving into a more specific recommendation for the report. The report's not going to stop here, and the map that I have on the poster board here to my right begins to look at ways you could configure, for example, the interstate into delivering projects on the interstate We're doing different iterations of this. This is actually an older one, but one I had available for display purposes. But this shows a new thinking on our part, anyway, is how we could deliver such a program in a corridor approach. Rather than a bridge-by-bridge approach, we've taken and lumped about 190 bridges together into about 20 different delivery packages. And in those packages, we're able to achieve a lot of economies of scale with the industry as far from a design and delivery standpoint, as well with the permitting process. We had a week-long seminar with all the permitting agencies for in-water work, both at the federal level and at the state level. To streamline that process, we're able to not get 191 permits, but able to get 20 permits for our projects, which vastly increased the speed and the cost in delivering the projects. So that's the path we're going down to put packages together. The actual configuration of the projects will look different in our final report than what that is, and more specific than what that is. But that's the work that's underway currently. Schedule-wise, we hope to have the draft report sometime after the first of the year available for release. We'll be having a presentation at our commission's meeting in January, where we'll be releasing the report there.
In addition to the work that Paul has been doing with the Bridge Option Committee group, the department has also looked at redeploying existing resources. We have redeployed approximately $9 million of current bridge maintenance and seismic retrofit dollars into I-84 and I-5 bridges. Also, with the legislative approval of the OTIA funding and the direction to put that on worst first projects, we have focused a lot of that money onto Interstate 5 and I-84. As the paper indicates, we have approximately $130 million worth of work underway on I-5 currently. That is construction and design work, so additional construction work this summer will be coming. Also, what's not included here, we have about $70 million worth of work being done on I-84, both in construction projects currently and work that is in design. In September, we met with the Transportation Commission to talk about the bridge problem and get some general guidance on the bridge option report. A couple of things that sort of are future that this committee needs to be aware of. The first one is the OTC directed us to seek a legislative change in what projects are eligible for modernization dollars currently under the law. There is legislation that requires the department to spend $56 million a year on modernization. That legislation does not include bridges, and it specifically excludes Interstate 5. We will be seeking legislation to allow the definition to be modified to allow the commission to consider bridges when they consider modernization as they update the state transportation improvement program. The second specific guidance they gave the department has to do with a cash management technique available with the federal government. This is called advanced construction. It allows us to federalize all our projects and then seek reimbursement at the beginning of the federal fiscal year as funds become available. That gets us our money back faster and allows us to reprogram that money to other projects. In addition, the federal government has approved the use of the OTIA dollars as match under another federal program, so we are getting reimbursed at 100%. So the commission in January, when they discuss the bridge options report, they will also be talking about federal earmarks and how we will allocate the advanced construction dollars that will become available over the next 3 to 5 years. So there are some trade-offs that need to be made and some discussion of the commission, and all of that is coming in January as part of this report and as part of our federal reauthorization request that will be made probably in February. As you can see, we've done a lot over the last year, but there's a lot more to do, and we're certainly open to the challenge that's coming, and we look forward to the next legislative session. And I think with that, we're available for questions.
Thank you very much for your comments and your report. Appreciate it. A couple of questions come to my mind on a couple of different tracks. First of all, weight-limited bridges. If you posted lower speed instead of lower weight, would that also take care of allowing some of the freight to continue to move?
Mr. Chairman, it would depend on the bridge, but that is a strategy that we do look at on a bridge-by-bridge basis. Depends on the design of the bridge and the characteristics of the roadway and how much speed. Having trucks going 5 miles an hour in the interstate is probably presents some safety issues. So there are some trade-offs, but on a bridge-by-bridge basis, that's something that that we do consider.
Yeah, I understand that wouldn't work on the interstate system, but some of the less traveled state routes and local routes represents an option. And then in addition to that, in order to complete the work on I-5 and I-84, round number, what's the total?
Mr. Chairman, including critical overpasses and interchanges as well as the mainline bridges that we're aware of, we're roughly talking about $1 billion for both I-5 and I-84.
Is that in addition to the funds that you've already expended this year and through OTA and other investments?
Yes.
Has the department looked at the opportunity of leveraging existing resources as far as you're spending, tell me the number, how much money you're spending currently on bridge repair and replacement, redirecting a portion of that to debt service and selling bonds and creating a larger pot of money to deal with this immediate need, recognizing the low interest rate environment that we're in and the opportunity to get the investment maybe sooner than later.
Chairman Starr, members of the committee, yes, the department has looked at that. We did have a discussion with the Transportation Commission in September. At this point, we have not received guidance to do that, but it is certainly something they are open to considering.
Does the department support that? Did they recommend that to the commission as a strategy?
Chairman Starr, members of the committee, yes, we did that. We actually presented a paper to the commission. I don't know if this committee has received a copy. We can certainly give you that. We went through and identified the different opportunities that would be available, and we did recommend that if they were to consider bonding, that somewhere between $10 and $16 million could be available for bonding. They considered that, so they would continue to consider that, but did not give us specific direction to move forward at this time.
And for every $1 million we bond, we were able to borrow about $10 million. Is that about right? That's about 10 to 1.
10 to 12, I think, is what they're using. Yes.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you partly answered this question in response to the chair's questions, but the numbers are staggering. I think you'll agree the numbers of dollars that we're talking about. The first question I've got really is, how much beyond your normal maintenance dollars is this? What are we talking about? Are these figures you've given us in the presentation net of normal maintenance dollars?
Chairman Starr, Representative Barnhart, we spend approximately $80 million a year on bridges. So the number, depending on how fast we got there, we in the 2003-05 budget, we are recommending $225 million for bridges in that biennium period. So the bridge problem at almost $5 billion, it would take a significant amount of time at the current funding level to address the problem and fix all of the bridges.
So the second question is really a combination question, and maybe this is the key one for me, is to ask how much money is the state going to have to come up with net after we deal with OTIA and the other federal resources, and how fast do you need it in order to prevent the kinds of economic dislocations that this presentation suggests we're facing if we don't do this.
Chairman Starr, Representative Barnard, that is part of the of what will be in the recommendation. We will do building blocks as to show under current revenue we can accomplish this much. With an additional $1 billion, we can accomplish this much more, and with $5 billion, we can accomplish all of it. That recommendation will be laid out in the report. I can't answer that for you today.
Let me interject that, just for the committee's understanding, I've been meeting with the department for a year on this issue, and that one question right there is the one that I've driven home to the department time and time again. For the legislature to I think, step up to the plate and really deal with this problem like I think we should, as stewards of the system, we really need to have a concrete plan from the department about how are we going to deal with this, what's the timeline, how much money is it going to cost, where is the money going to be spent, and as much as they know, and to a certain extent, just collecting that information for the department is an expensive process, and to a certain extent, we're going to have to trust their best judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Quite frankly, we've got some really qualified and highly skilled individuals working there that we should trust their judgment on this issue. But that one question is one that we really, as a legislature, I think, have to have answered as we move forward into this session next January.
Thanks, sir. One follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair. The last piece of that, and it may be covered in your contemplated reporting for February, is how long, let's suppose we can find the money, which given the magnitude of it here, is going to be a significant issue for us. How long is it going to be before we have to do it again? I mean, can we build a long-range, and maybe another way of asking it is, can we build a long-range plan to maintain the transportation system and understand what the actual amortized cost of that is going to be for us? And will that be included in your February report? Maybe that's the way I should ask it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnard, I think I'd take a shot at that, but that specific question is not a focus of our report. Bridges, as I said earlier, typically last 50 to as much as, you know, 100 years. Putting a plan together and what's going to transpire during that time, what's going to happen to truck waste, what's going to happen to volume, what's going to happen to the environmental erosion of the bridges. There are many different factors that depict or determine the life of a bridge. It's hard to put that strategy together. What we've been putting focus on for the report is what is it going to take to get us over the hump that we see in front of us, created not only by a aggressive bridge building era back in the 30s as well as the 50s, but also by this design issue with a certain segment of those bridges, trying to get through that hump and back down to a more manageable bridge program that we can on an annual basis come up with a dollar amount that we're able to annually maintain our bridges at a level that's acceptable.
Can I make just a comment? I mean, the comment I would make at this point is clearly the legislature and the people need to have, in the long term at least, maybe not this year, but sometime pretty soon, an understanding of what this transportation system actually costs us on an annualized basis, and recognizing that the numbers are not absolute by any stretch. It appears to me, as the guy coming in late and not really understanding this system, as though we probably have not been doing that, as though this thing may have caught us by surprise. And if that's true, we want to make sure it doesn't happen again. And I'm sure that I'm not saying anything that you don't already know, but I want you to know that I know it too now, and I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for your comment. Representative Berger and Brown and Henson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that you have faced, or correct me if I'm wrong, is that so many of the bridges were built at the same time. Isn't that correct? So part of the problem that you're running into right now, if it's a part of maintenance, may not occur exactly as it is now. Is that correct? The other thing that really worries me is the I-5 corridor. You're building it better and better for a truck route, and I just wonder if that's a real advisable thing, and what do you see the future of I-5?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Verger, being someone that lives on I-5 in Roseburg and sees the trucks that go through there every day, what I've seen and experienced in the last 5 or 10 years is even dramatic increases on truck traffic as I drive up and down I-5. Our volumes indicate increasing growth. The economy of the state, as we're finding the model, is in the Portland area as well as in the interstate corridors and largely in the I-5 corridor. The trends we're seeing is for that to continue. The viability of having that large amount of truck traffic go off the interstate system that's there today and take alternative routes, whether it's 97 or 101, while it may be possible, those communities, those roadways are not set up for that volume. We experienced that during the detour through Riddle that we had for 3 weeks. And having a certain portion of trucks go through downtown as well as a certain portion go on a detour that was largely Highway 58 over to 97 to bypass southern I-5 in Oregon. Large amount of increases on those routes. And for short periods of time, it's probably tolerable. But to think that we can make those kind of shifts would take a significant investment for those communities as well as for us to accommodate those volume of truck traffic off of the interstate.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm 100% supportive of improving the system, and the political reality is that we have people that are going to be looking at the budgets, the money that is going to be needed from all over the state of Oregon. And also even from the valley. It is very difficult to convince people to put money behind something if they face congestion and we continue to improve a truck route without improving anything else. I-84 is not the problem in the movement of traffic and trucks and people as I-5 is. And so that's my concern, is the political reality of accomplishing what we want to accomplish and doing what we're doing by improving the economy, which is very good, and improving I-5 without looking at other ways of convenience to the people who live here and their quality of life. So,
Chairman Starr, Representative Berger, if I could address that. That's one of the dilemmas that the commission faces when we talk about the advanced construction funds that are available. It's balancing the needs for, say, tourism on the coast and improvements to coastal routes, funds available to address the emergencies that come up that we know are going to come up around the state, particularly for the heavy haulers. If you look at the maps, one of the maps that Paul had passed out showing where the heavy haul, the percentage of trucks, we know we're going to have problems in those areas and we're going to need funds to address it, in addition to addressing the I-5, I-84 corridor. So part of the strategy will be to try and identify what is the sequencing of improvements to ultimately get I-5 and I-84 completed. How much funds do we think we reasonably need to hold in reserve to address these emergencies that come up, because we know they're going to happen. So hopefully that will be part of the overall strategy that we deliver to you.
One last comment. Let me say that you're just a few years away from a lot of truck traffic on the coast, because you have trees that are going to have to be cut, are going to be cut on private land. And so these are the things that, in tying into what Representative Barnhart has said, we've got to look out in a vision on the transportation system.
The other day, just last week, they're replacing a bridge down on 101 south of Yahats, and they had to bring a large crane in to place some of the material there, and they and bringing the crane in from up north somewhere, maybe from Portland, but anyway, they got down, there's a bridge closed, Spencer Creek Bridge, it's got weight restriction on it, just north of town. So they rerouted the crane up Highway 229 that goes up to, it's really a very secondary road that goes up to Siletz and around. That crane got partway up there, and because of the size of it and maybe some of the driving that took place, but got out on the shoulder of the road and it upended the crane. So the crane that they needed to fix the bridge down at Yahas was upside down in the ditch up by Celeste. So that just serves to underline some of the problems that happen when you have bridge construction that's, or the restrictions placed upon the bridges wherever they're at in our system. The OTIA dollars that are being used as leverage, what kind of percentage of that match is, does that make up? Is it a 50-50 or with Fed
Chairman, Representative Brown, on the federal side, it's anywhere between 10 and 20% of his local match. So we have a list of projects that were identified that are eligible, so we're getting 100%, essentially 100% reimbursement on those projects. But generally, it's 10% or 20% federal match somewhere in that area.
And is that just on the interstate system?
That is on a list of projects that were identified under this particular federal program called TEO 45. And I can get you the list. I don't have that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you're on the right track. This will, it's just imperative, though, that we get that your report as early in the session as we can, but it's clearly something we have to deal with. The main question, though, was, especially in light of the design flaw problem, is that peculiar to Oregon, or is there, were there similar flaws in that time period made national at the same time the interstate system was under construction?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, we're working with Federal Highway Administration to do a comprehensive research of other states. Some of the preliminary information we've got back is other states do have used the same design. It was a national design in the late 50s. And some other states are experiencing some of the cracking that we've experienced here in Oregon. But also appears that Oregon in the late 50s used that design a few more years longer than some of the other states, which transitioned to a current design, which is a pre-stressed beam design that we currently use. So we hung on to the design during a very heavy bridge building era. It's a very efficient, very cost-effective design that our contractors were geared up to use. We hung on to it, you know, a few more years longer than most other states did, and so I have a larger population of those bridges than most other states. Other states, it looks like, a state like California also has expanded their freeway a lot more aggressively than we have in Oregon, and thus has replaced those bridges through an expansion mode that most of our rural interstate especially hasn't experienced. In the Portland metro area, as you can see in the dots on the map, most of the Portland metro bridges have been expanded over those last 40 or 50 years. And so those aren't the ones that are largely of concern. It's more the rural stretches of the interstate and other key routes that we have around the state.
Thank you.
Anything else in the committee? Other questions? The reports that you're having done, can you tell the committee a general number as far as how much that's costing the department to put that together?
Chairman Starr, members of the committee, I don't have that, but I think we could certainly calculate that. It is primarily being done by in-house staff, both on the highway division and transportation planning and development. And then we do have representatives from the city and county on that task force. We should be able to put that together.
But don't you have some consultants that are working as well as doing some research on the status of the bridges?
Representatives, our members of the committee, yes, we will. We are going to be using, I don't know if they are underway, but I can find that out, consultants to help do some of the scoping work. So we will have a number for that, yes.
Very good. There's nothing further with the committee. Thank you very much for your report and your good work.
Thank you.
Next up, committee, we've got some bill introductions for pre-session filing. These bills will be pre-session filed, provided we do them all. So they'll be introduced into the process come January 13th, and they'll be the sponsorship will be the House Energy and Transportation Committee. And we will go, as soon as we have the packet from Janet, we'll just kind of go down the list, one at a time. Recognize this is not, you're not voting on the final outcome of a piece of legislation, but just basically allowing this idea to be moved forward into the legislative process. Quite frankly, my sense is that if this committee wasn't to introduce these bills, that there would be individual sponsors that would probably pick them up anyway. So either way, I think we'll get to have the opportunity to deal with these issues come January 13th. Quite obviously as well, this is a House committee, these bills will be introduced as House bills. So that you all that are staying in the House will have first shot at it, and I'll have to wait to see how you handle them, watching from the Senate side.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Brown.
I would go ahead and move that we proceed with drafting all of these bills that are on here. We're certainly going to have the opportunity to discuss and debate these later during the regular session, and as you said, that they will find another avenue to be drafted. Unless someone on the committee has a specific problem with some of them, I would recommend we proceed with drafting all of those.
Okay, I will accept that in the form of a motion, and unfortunately, we do not have an healthy draft for the Regional Transportation Authority, RTA. I don't have a number, so that one will have to be, we'll have to pick up at some other point. But we do have a healthy number for the mileage-based insurance tax credit, that's what the blank on the sheet.
The mileage-based insurance tax credit on page, listed on page two is LC1237.
And in addition to that, there's two additional LC drafts that I actually picked up this morning, and that aren't on your list. And they are LC draft 1233, and I'll tell you what that bill is. It's a bill with a relating clause that says relating to transportation. The bill increases their vehicle registration fee, currently at $15 a year to $20 a year. Quite frankly, it's a vehicle to move a transportation funding package, provided the support for one of those in the House starting on January 13th. That's what LC 1233 is. LC 1232, you also have just recently handed to you, and I picked it up this morning as well. That bill is a redraft, quite frankly, of a bill that was passed by the legislature in 1995 that dealt with service roads to landlocked properties that were landlocked because of highway construction that went through and basically landlocked properties. And out of that, there were some deeded accesses that were deeded to properties. And there's some disputes about whether or not, if the property changes hands, whether that deeded access changes hands with the new property owner. This is an issue that the legislature passed in 95. Quite frankly, the governor vetoed the bill in 95. Both houses of the legislature passed it. There's a handful of these around the state. There's one in Lake Oswego in particular that the department has worked on trying to resolve the issue, did a really good job of negotiating a settlement, only to have the commission not accept the negotiated settlement between the property owner and ODOT. By introducing this bill, it allows us to continue to have the discussion. I'll recognize that it's somewhat controversial, but it will allow us to continue to have that discussion through the next legislative session. So I would ask that that the committee provide an aye vote for that draft as well. So those are the drafts that you have before you today. I will, in restating Representative Brown's motion, I will include the other two drafts as well. So Representative Brown has moved that we introduce as committee bills LC Draft 1119, County Transit District Funding, LC Draft 1305, Waste Tire Recycling Account, LC 1304, Solid Waste Disposal Fee for Development of Scrap Tire Market, LC 1303, Tire Recycling Board, LC 697, Truck Chassis Safety at Ports, LC 979, Truck Wait Time at Ports, LC 1237, the Mileage-Based Insurance Tax Credit Incentive, and LC 1232, which is the Local Service Road Draft, and LC 1233, which is the Registration Fee Increase. Discussion.
Under discussion, Mr. Chairman, on LC 979, I just haven't had a feel of back from my port at all on this bill. We don't have a crowded port, but they may have a feeling either in support of the position of the port in Portland or in position of the union.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the only thing that concerns me is we've not had any feedback from the port on this particular, on either one of the bills for that matter. So do you, does the committee really want to move forward before we hear anything from that?
Representative Hanson, do you have your hand up? Do you want to accept that, or do you have to accept
my
comment?
My preference would be to go ahead and introduce all of these. I don't think that in any way means that we're necessarily endorsing them, or we're making a final judgment on them. But this is just to move the process forward. And I think one of the things by doing that, we should give an early warning to all the parties that are involved in these issues, that they need to be talking to us, and that these are going to have serious discussions in the legislature. So I think I've got a lot of questions on all of these, but I think we enhance the process if we get them introduced early rather than waiting until we get more information.
I think his point is well taken in that it does alert people. So I think that with that point being made, I have no other comments.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Hanson. Other comments? Any more discussion? Is there objection to the motion? Seeing none, well, that's the easiest way to do bill introductions all at once. Appreciate that. And we will, I guess, adjourn for lunch, or recess for lunch, and reconvene at 1:30. We will recess until 1:30 for lunch.